Welcome to Inside the World Economic Forum. I'm Michelle Mishler.
And I'm Michael Hanley. What if? This is the hypothetical question most of us have asked ourselves at one time or another. In today's podcast, we ask experts in their field what their what if scenario is.
In an interdependent, fast-moving world, we are increasingly confronted by risks that are complex in nature and global in consequence. From cyber-terrorism to a supervolcano, today you will hear what some of the biggest risks are that we face today.
First, we hear from Douglas Redeker. He's a member of the executive board of the International Monetary Fund. He worries about whether global institutions are able to solve systemic problems.
Well, I think for this coming year, we're watching an increasing stress being put on global organizations, global institutions, to solve very large systemic global problems. And I think one of the big concerns is whether, in fact, those organizations and institutions at the global level are up to the challenge.
What do you consider a realistic worst-case scenario?
Well, I think when you get to global problems, whether they are economic, climate, other problems that are truly global in nature, if those organizations are relied upon by the world and they are incapable of solving them, that is to me a very, very big risk, because it's one thing if you know there is no backstop, there is no global organization that is going to address these issues. You know you've got to find another alternative. If you believe that these organizations are in fact structured to be effective in solving problems, but they fail, then there may be no plan B, and you may end up with a scenario in which problems get worse and not better as a result.
So what would be the chain of events if we go step by step?
Well, I think we're already seeing at the financial level, the economics crisis, the financial crisis that we've seen, that lessons have been learned, allegedly, but have the solutions to those problems actually been embraced by global organizations? Or are we at a stage now where a lot of the financial crisis that we had in the last 5 years, we are watching as economic crises potentially start to rear their head again, and the international organizations that many believe are tasked with solving it are either not resource able to do so or are not effective in being able to do so. And that devolves down to then the risk of a regional response to, for example, the European financial crisis. If that crisis is to be solved, one would expect, many expect, that to be done at a global level, because the potential impact of it is global. It is systemic. We've learned that, or at least we should have. But are the institutions that are there to actually provide that systemic backstop actually robust enough and effective enough to do so? Or are we back at a regional level? If a regional problem has a regional solution, that's good. But if a regional problem becomes a global problem and there is not a solution at either the global level or the regional level, then you have a reversion to nationalism. And nationalism is everyone's worst fear.
Do you see us as moving closer to the precipice, or are we going in the right direction?
Well, we are, at the time we're having this conversation, we are at a very precarious stage. It is unclear as to whether global organizations, regional organizations, national governments in conjunction with one another and on their own are able to step up and provide both the intellectual, the structural, the political, excuse me, and the financial resources to actually stop what could be, as we've heard in the press thus far in the past several weeks when this is being recorded, but as I think everyone will admit, we are on the verge of, if things go wrong, an economic scenario across the globe akin to that of the 1930s, the Great Depression. The idea here is, how do you get in front of that and make sure that never happens? And we are watching that right now play itself out. Personally, I think the institutions, regional, national, and global, are individually not up to the task, but collectively, my hope is that they are. And what I mean by that is, each one, because these problems are so large, are actually incapable of doing enough on their own. Working together, there's a chance that they can do it right. But that remains an open question as we're having this conversation.
Robert Wainwright is the director of Europol, the European law enforcement agency that handles criminal intelligence, and he's concerned about the internet.
What would you say is the greatest or the most underappreciated risk in your field?
It's certainly in the cyber domain, I think, and in particular, the risk that I'm most concerned about is the instability and the vulnerability of the internet infrastructure. You know, we're living in an increasingly hyper-connected world. That's one of the big themes of Davos 2012. We now have 5 billion devices, computers and other things that are connected to the internet, remotely accessed to the internet. It includes almost 500 million smartphones, for example, but also everything from cars to kitchen ovens as well. That increasing connectivity is making the internet hugely important for business, for our home life, for our private life, and it creates a vulnerability, I think. And there's a sense, certainly in my world, that we understand the benefits of the internet far more than the risks.
Could you walk us through an attack? How this worst-case scenario might play out?
Okay, it would look like, I think, a malicious attack by hacktivists, or in the worst-case scenario, even terrorists, on the core systems that maintain the infrastructure of the internet. In particular, two, I think, that are absolutely critical to the internet working. The domain and name system, the DNS, which is effectively the internet's directory. This is what converts the numerical codes of IP addresses into words that can be searched on the internet. So if you attack that, bring that down, web pages are no longer accessible. And the border gateway protocol, which connects the regional hubs of the internet to make it the global instrument that it is and that it needs to be to support society and business. If you attack those two, you take the internet down. And an attack in particular using botnets, distributed denial of service attacks, could in some cases take away that infrastructure and have a huge effect, I think, on the way in which we do our business.
Can you give me examples of cases where the vulnerabilities of the system were exploited?
Well, the last time that these core systems were attacked in a significant way, as far as I know, was way back in 2007. And then some of the so-called root servers of the domain name system were indeed damaged. There are 13 of these root servers regionally around the world. I think 6 of them were damaged in that attack, 2 of them quite seriously. It caused some disruption, which was quickly recovered, and therefore it didn't have long-lasting damage. Having said that, I think the work of Anonymous and other hacktivist groups right now is showing that they're using increasingly sophisticated methods, particularly botnets, and my fear is that they have a greater capability now than they had in 2007. They're showing that in different ways right now, in terms of the disruptive attacks that they have on financial institutions. And also, of course, we have a huge cybercrime industry, organized crime syndicates that themselves are developing very sophisticated ways to steal identity, carry out fraudulent activity online to the tune of multi-billion dollars each year. So there's a big profit motivation here. I think from the hacktivist side, possibly the terrorists as well, there are some very dangerous motivations that could inspire a very disruptive attack on the critical infrastructure that maintains the internet.
If we take the case of organized crime, do any noteworthy examples stand out?
Well, I think the cybercrime is generated by the need to make money, of course, and in particular some of the threats that we're monitoring in the European Police Agency are those that allow a digital underground economy to flourish. In particular, personal data has become the oil in the machine. The stealing of millions of personal data from everyday citizens, using that to create fraudulent identities online and using those identities to carry out massive attacks on people, but also governments and businesses as well. In 1 year alone, we estimate that a minimum of 100 billion euros in VAT fraud alone is committed online, even in the European Union. So we see that. We see the more traditional attacks as well of cybercrime syndicates being involved in the proliferation of child sex abuse images online as well. So it's a multidimensional problem, one that's certainly getting harder to police.
And how do you police it?
Well, there's a lot that we can do in the law enforcement community. There's a lot we can do to increase our digital forensic capability to investigate and identify early enough the first signs of serious criminal activity online. This is about increasing our capacity levels in that space, increasing our intelligence capabilities, increasing the extent to which we can share intelligence between national police agencies, and there's a particular role that Europol has in the EU to promote that. But I think that law enforcement can't do this alone, and what we're seeing is the internet, of course, is central to all aspects of business and life, and it's important, therefore, that a multi-stakeholder community arrest this problem. And that's why at this year's summit in Davos, I'm part of a major new cyber resilience initiative that we're running through the World Economic Forum that's trying to sign up business leaders, political leaders, law enforcement chiefs to the idea that we have to move on in our work to defeat cybercrime now, away from the traditional area of a dependence on securing our perimeters. It's not just bigger locks we need anymore, but a recognition that when we are online, we can't operate anymore with zero risk. And therefore, this is about building resilience levels, building better awareness of the problems, and recognizing also that this is an interdependent problem, that we are all dependent on this hyper-connected world that we live in now. All our businesses, all our social interests are dependent on that. And that means, therefore, we need a community response. And this initiative in the World Economic Forum is driving that forward so that in the future, multi-stakeholder community can attack this problem in a much more comprehensive way than we've ever seen before.
Dr. Satoru Nishikawa is a member of the Ministry for Land, Infrastructure, Transport and Tourism for the Government of Japan and is the chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Catastrophic Risk. Here's what if is the possibility of a large volcanic eruption.
How do you define catastrophic risk?
Catastrophic risk is a big accident or disaster which develops in an overwhelming speed. And it affects a large number of people and would spread into a very wide geographical region. I think that would be the easiest way to define what a catastrophic risk is.
So which is the most underappreciated risk in your field?
I think that would be a large-scale volcanic eruption. And it will spew enormous amount of ashes to the air. And the ashes would spread into the global atmosphere and maybe in 3 or 4 days or up to 1 week. And it would cause a global cooling. And it might sound queer of these volcanic eruptions, but 2 years ago, we have experienced the Iceland volcano. The volcanic ashes covered the European airspace and halted all the airlines. The scale was not so big that the ashes stayed in the European airs. But way back in 1991, there was a Pinatubo volcano eruption in the Philippines. And the ashes circled around the Earth and affected the climate. Also, every 100 or 200 years, there is an enormous volcanic eruption. And when these happen, the global climate changes. And of course, agricultural production would soar down. And that's one of the, I would say, risks that are recognized by certain scientists. But it is totally not recognized by the general public nor the business community.
These interviews usually center around smaller scale man-made risks, things that can be addressed through engaging with different human actors. How do we protect ourselves from the forces of nature?
It is really impossible to stop a volcanic eruption. But we do know how the speed of the ashes would disperse into the atmosphere. It can be numerically calculated. So at least we can assess the impact of such volcanic ash dispersion. And nowadays, the scientists would be able to calculate, for example, what would be the effect to the global climate. And then we may be able to, for example, adapt the agricultural crops to be more suitable for the cooler climate. But it's going to be difficult because this would happen in a week's time. But that would be the, I would say that this might be the most, I'll say, catastrophic risk that would affect the entire globe and also all the international community. And if you look back into the historical records, there are records of such volcanic ash dispersal. And in the Middle Ages, Europe has experienced famine from such ash dispersion.
Looking back at the Icelandic volcano eruption of 2010, do you think we have the means to respond effectively to a much larger scale event?
I think we were quite successful in avoiding plane crashes because from the 1991 Philippine Pinatubo volcanic eruption, we have learned that certain volcanic ashes would clog the engines of an airplane and might down the aircraft. So in the Iceland volcano case, the European air authorities really halted the airspace, which resulted in no casualties. And that was a big success. On the other hand, in 1 week and 2 weeks, people started to get irritated with the fact that you cannot use the airplanes. And that is one of the worries that I have, because we were able to avoid human tragedies. But on the other hand, it had economic consequences. And let's see how these two would balance.
Given the urgency and the more short-term aspect of the other risks we face, financial, political, social, do you feel that this risk you described isn't taken seriously enough?
Well, I'm afraid that, I would say, most of the people would not really take it serious regarding volcanoes, because it's not a, I would say, frequent phenomenon. It's not a popular phenomenon. But on the other hand, there are historic evidences, and also the volcanologists are fully aware of this danger. And there's a big gap between what the scientists know and how the general public or the business society recognize such risk.
So our only way to address this risk is to inform people?
Yes. For example, at least the airline industry recognizes such risk. But there should be other industries who should be aware of such risks. For example, if the volcanic ashes have the sulfur dioxide in the particles, it may penetrate into all of the personal computers and would damage the electronic circuits, and which would result in a massive, I'll say, information crisis. And of course, you can take measures to protect the most important computers by having the air masks and such.
How optimistic are you?
I must say that the human beings have experienced such phenomena maybe every 100 years. 100 years ago, maybe it was not a global disaster because it was accepted as a famine. But nowadays, with the global population has doubled, and the impact of the shortage of food is much more serious than 100 years ago. I think that is the real impact of such risk. And food shortage would really directly into social unrest. And that's what we have to be really serious about.
And that's it for this week's edition of our podcast. I'm Michelle Mishler.
And I'm Michael Hanley. Join us again next week when we'll have a look at the latest edition of the World Economic Forum's Energy Report.